Hello, my name is Janice B. Gordon, and this is Scale Your Sales Podcast. Welcome to Scale Your Sales Podcast, listed number 9 of 43 best podcasts for every sales professional. I am Janice B. Gordon, the customer growth expert, recommended by LinkedIn Sales as one of 15 innovative influencers to follow. In today's episode of Scale Your Sales Podcast, my guest and I talked about founders and how quickly founders want to jump off from the sales and bring in someone instead or move to outbound sales. So we talked about how this is really ineffective and how there's real opportunities to actually improving on their inbound sales and really honing the sales engine and sales skills. My next guest is the founder of The Sales Doctor, a revenue growth agency designed to eliminate the revenue bleed caused by archaic sales enablement practices. Welcome to Scale Your Sales Podcast, Chet Lovgren.
Thank you for having me, Janice. Excited to be here.
Oh, it's great to have you. I really want to kind of get started looking at your area of expertise, early stage startups and founders. When you say that they want to really kind of go straight into going for outbound and not really focusing enough or using their expertise on inbound, tell me more about that.
Yeah, I think it sounds sexy to people, and so they want to do it because that's sales, right? We go outbound and we build pipeline, but I don't understand why a lot of founders want to do that because outbound takes a couple different things. Number one, the conversion rates are really low, and so run the data and see if there are other ways that that time could be spent developing a channel partnership. If you have investors, tapping into your investor network, tapping into portfolio companies that they might have at certain VC firms if you're funded that might need your product or your service. It just doesn't make sense, because especially if you don't have salespeople and you're a founder yourself and you're doing your sales, like the amount of activities that's needed to really get to one close, one deal is so much outbound activity that has to happen because of the conversion rates. So unless you're going to supply a team, but then again, right now you're increasing your burn rate, you're eating into your capital. And so there's so many other ways to make money. And I have a very skeptical viewpoint too, that a lot of people don't like, because they're like, well, you've never actually founded a SaaS company before. So people hate when I say this, but if you don't have a decent inbound funnel, then guess what? Maybe nobody wants what you're selling. So if you can't like focus on the right, and there's so many agencies out there now, there's so many overseas agencies, people that are experts that'll work for very little. So you're not spending a lot of money, but getting a lot of results when it comes to even automating some email marketing, on-page, off-page SEO, simple things. So I'm just populating higher when someone is searching a relative thing associated with my product or service on Google, first and foremost. Secondly, creating content. People say creating content is hard. Creating content is not that hard. Creating content is hard because you don't know how to do it yet. But when you actually figure out how you can spend 1 hour a week creating a week's worth of content, if not more, it becomes very routine and very simple to do. And pretty soon now you're repurposing your content. You have content on LinkedIn, TikTok, YouTube Shorts, Instagram, but that's all stemming from that 1 hour that you spent. I'm sure when you record these podcast episodes, you're coming out with 2 to 3 LinkedIn posts, a couple short form videos for TikTok, Instagram, YouTube Shorts. You could post those on LinkedIn as well. Quote cards for Instagram, long form video for your YouTube page. Like there's so much you can do from just this one conversation. Transcribe it, write a weekly newsletter article about it, make that a longer form, put it as a blog on your website. Tons of different things that you can do. Operationally, it's tough if you've never done it. I've been doing that for quite a while. So for me, it's like a snap of a finger. But go to Fiverr, go to Upwork. There are plenty of people that you can pay $7.50, $8 an hour to help you do this stuff, who do this stuff for other people. Copywriters, podcast producers, blog writers, all that kind of stuff. And so I think there's just so many better things we can do than just saying, I need to grow, so let's go outbound. It doesn't make sense to me why people are so quick to want to go to outbound. It's grueling emotionally, physically, mentally tough work. I'm tired if I have to outbound at the end of the day. Like, I don't want to go to the gym. I don't want to play with my kids. I want to sit back and watch TV. I'm like, I just want to check out. I just made 128 dials and got told no 8 times, right? It's exhausting works. It's a lot more fulfilling to collaborate with others, build things, and then see those results happen as opposed to just being out there on your own, making a bunch of dials, trying to build pipeline.
I thought it was interesting what you said, that actually they haven't necessarily got proof of product yet, mm-hmm. and they're wanting to jump, you know, it's like bright, shiny object, kind of like jump elsewhere before they've got that. Unless you actually have a tap of potential customers that you can turn off and on, really you don't have your engine in place as yet, and that can take quite a bit of trial and error. But rather than jumping off thinking that, you know, you're going to get more just because you get more leads, but they're not great quality leads, you haven't done the research, all of that, then you know, you haven't really got a business system, a sales system. Without a sales system, then you haven't really got a business with revenue that you can sustain. So it's really interesting because I have worked with quite a few kind of on a sell accelerator programs on the sales side and coaching founders. And the reason why I picked this up, because it really resonated with me. So often founders start a business and what they want to ask me about is how they can recruit salespeople. And it's like, hold on a minute.
Yeah.
You know, you're the salesperson. You need to understand the engine of your business, you know. So whether you like it or not, you need to start getting great at sales. Then, only then can you train somebody about your unique market, that, you know, what your product does and how it benefits your customer. You already instinctively know all of that because you created it, but someone, just because you think they're good at selling, isn't necessarily going to be able to sell that to someone else unless you have the engine that you've tried and tested behind that. So I think it's quite interesting you're experiencing that people just quickly want to jump off and hand it over to someone else, whereas that's the gold.
Yeah, people have 15 customers, they get $2.5 million in funding. The first thing we want to do is go hire a founding AE. Why? And then for every salesperson you hire, you're going to have to hire a support person or customer success person as well. You know, so not only that, but if somebody's selling the deals, who's going to support them? And then it becomes a problem because people want to hire a founding AE. It's not really clear cut defined what's going to happen once we sign a customer up. And then basically account management becomes part of that AE's job. And they're like, I didn't sign up for this. I thought it was an AE. You know what I mean? Like, I'm not setting up admin instances of the software and doing kickoff calls and all that. That's supposed to be customer success. And I'm not answering calls when stuff breaks. That's support. But, oh, we didn't think about that. Oh, now we're even increasing our burn rate even more. It's like, oh my gosh, next thing you know, you're like out of business, right? Like a lot of people are going out of business. And I think that's why, is it was just growth at all costs, throw money at the problem, not thinking about, well, as a founder, like, and I'm going to give some tough love to founders. I know a lot of founders who, the reason they want to hire a salesperson is because they want to go golf on a Friday afternoon, or they want to log off at 3 o'clock every day because I'm the boss. I'm the founder now. I get the life of relaxation and luxury. Sorry, Charlie, but if you're not at, you know, 50 million in ARR right now, you're not there yet. You haven't made it. That's a cute little 10 customer pipeline you got. You know what I mean? But you got a long ways to go. And I think founder hubris is a really big thing where founders are like, I'm the boss now. I shouldn't be doing the heavy lifting. No, until you're Series B, you're probably going to be doing a lot of the heavy lifting. Like, until you've raised a significant amount of capital, you have an incredible run rate, you're bringing in tons of revenue, you have a sales team, CS team built out, marketing on firing on all cylinders. No, you're in this for the long haul. You are the owner operator. You know, I mean, there are restaurants that make $1.5 million a year, and the guy or the girl who was the chef who opened the restaurant 20 years ago is still in the back of the kitchen cooking the food, right? And not enough people, you know, people, I think people, especially in SaaS, look at founder, they feel like that's not, you know, that's not sexy or luxurious to be able to do that. Like, it's not a good look if a founder is out there doing their sales. Well, no, that's what it should be. That's how a healthy company runs lean and keeps growing and doesn't burn all their capital. 20 VC, or I'm sorry, All In Podcast talked about that with extending your runway, basically, I have $2.5 million and I want to hire two sellers and a support person and a developer in America, I probably have a year of runway. If I hire a developer overseas and maybe a marketing person at an agency ad hoc, and I continue to sell, I just extend my runway by about 18 more months. Now I have 2.5 years of runway. And yeah, it's all about how much runway do you have. And when you do outbound, you're not giving yourself, you have to have a ton of runway, or what I also call investor patience, to be able to do that, because the results aren't going to come in 2 to 3 months. It's a 6 to 12 month program at a minimum before you really start seeing the results you think you're going to see.
Yeah. And I was going to say, you know, before you added at a minimum, and especially now in this environment, people are so much more cautious. But why do you think it's particular to the SaaS founders that have this kind of mentality that, you know, that's not my role, and, you know, they want to kind of kick off and be the boss? Whereas you've just given an example of someone that started a restaurant business and they're still in the back of the kitchen, they're still cooking 10 or so years later. Why is there such a different mentality?
It's a great question. And the best answer I could say is, if I think about my experience in the restaurant industry versus my experience in SaaS, is that most people who go and open a business, probably 90%, I would say, are just creating a new job for themselves, which is the worst thing you can do. I don't want to work for my boss anymore. I can do it better than them. I'm going to go start my own thing. So for better or for worse, the chefs in the back of the kitchen that own the restaurant that are doing that, might be a good thing, might be a bad thing. But on the founder side, it's that I can do this better than my boss. And this is what my boss did, so I should be the boss, but nobody's going to hire me to be the boss. So I'm going to go start my own little company, especially now. Like, how many little tiny AI tech startups are there where it's like, you were an SDR for 2 years. What, you're a founder of a company now? Get out of here. And not that people would put their money and their life in that person's hands, but I'm even seeing people that, you know, maybe they've been in the business for 8 years, they had a director of sales title, or maybe a VP of sales stint for like 18 months somewhere. And they're like, I could do better than our founders. I'm going to go create a product. But because they didn't have any support, or because their founders or CEOs were off in Thailand for a week at a time, not answering calls, they think that's what a founder should be. They think a founder is Mark Zuckerberg or Elon Musk, and those people are off doing podcasts. So Joe Rogan, and they're, you know what I mean, like doing Muay Thai in the afternoon and fighting in competitions like Zuckerberg is now. And they think that's what their life should be. They don't think my life should be, oh, I'm still going to be tied to a desk about 60 hours a week, actually 40 hours a week, but also now 60 hours a week because I'm a founder and I have 9 million other things that I'm responsible for, as opposed to when I was just an AE or a VP of sales or a VP of CS or a CTO at a company, right? They see what their founder was doing at a successful company in some situations, like much larger funded and revenue generating company than they were at. And they think that's what I should be doing because that's what my boss was doing. All they do is become their own boss. And that's the worst job you could ever have, being your own boss and creating your own job. And so I think that's part of what it is I see what I see from my boss and how they live. Yeah, but what's the context around that? You're working at a Series C company that's bringing in, you know, $250 million in ARR. That's a little different. You're not even bringing $250 a month. So that's why, you know, your boss went on a week-long vacation to Ireland. That's why it worked that way. So I think that part of it is just like sales managers, right? Most sales managers forget that they're no longer responsible for the job. They're responsible for the people responsible for the job. So they just keep doing the job. And I think it's the same thing when people move into founders and SaaS, is they just do what they've seen. They don't actually have a good view of like what startup founders need to be successful, or that insight on what it took.
Yeah. And I think it's that resonates with me in my experience. We gain a lot of system knowledge, business knowledge, experience from the larger companies we've worked from. We break away and we take with us that kind of big company mentality think. And we think that that's how we're supposed to have a small business and create systems around that. And actually what I talk to my CEOs and founders about, and what several things, but what one thing is, looking at your customers, you've got to be clear about your customers, what their expectations are, what customer success really looks like, and understand what their, not only their needs, but their wants as well, and in particularly their priorities. If you've got all of that landscape completely covered and really in deep dive into that, then you work back. Then you work back. You work back at, okay, well, what do I need to be? What is our culture? How can we consistently provide that? What does, even changing the product, how do we need to change this product in order to meet the needs of, we know there's a significant group of people that have this characteristic, and we've gone really deep. Now we work backwards. Forget about the big company systems. Let's just work backwards with what are the wants, needs, and priorities of this group of customers. And you design it from that point of view. And it means you've removed all of the blocks that you would have put in place and barriers, because you're not starting from the big company mentality. You're actually starting from who's most important here, the customer, the buyers, and what they want and what their priorities are.
Yeah. And not enough people have seen that play out. And again, to the restaurant, the restaurant analogy, most people that are chefs worked around other great chefs who started restaurants. Every chef I've ever worked for knew what they were doing because they saw another chef that were doing it. And a lot of those chefs were then owners. And then as they moved into a sous chef position, they started getting some of those business things that restaurants had to do under their belt. Oh my gosh, this is how I create relationships with suppliers. This is how I create relationships with service people that are going to come and clean my kitchen hoods once a month. And the people that are going to come and clean the restaurant floors every single night. This is how I hire people. This is where I can hire people. I use Indeed locally, or I don't know, is Craigslist still a thing? But right, like you start to learn the higher you climb up, to the point where, since those are not as far removed as someone who is an AE or director of sales at a big company, or even a medium-sized company, if you're thinking about, tech and how many employees, 250 to 100 or so, you see a lot more on how to run things. And typically, you know, restaurant owners, the things they do differently when they want to go open their restaurants, because they have their own ideas or concepts around menu items and what they want to serve. I know a guy in Toronto who's got like a Japanese soul food fusion restaurant. And the menu is so creative and so cool. And I was like, what did you do before this? He's like, I worked in French cuisine for a decade. And it became so boring to me that I said, what are the two craziest types of cuisines that I can combine together that are going to taste good? And I found that, like, basically, like soul food from the South, when I spent time in like Louisiana and Alabama, and Japanese food merged together were incredible. I started playing around with things. And so his concept just grew. And now he's got like 5 locations across Canada of this. It's not like fast casual, but it's definitely, it's not fancy either. It's like, you can literally go in, they serve things in a plate with a nice little checkered liner. Right. But he knows how to do all the things that he knows how to do, because he worked for an owner, operator, head chef, and he learned the business. Here's how I set up relationships with suppliers and distributors. Here's how I do accounting, because I'm actually entering in inventory counts and expenses and invoices. And so he got to see all the things that he needed to do. We don't really get to see all that as an employee. Like, you want to ask me what a CFO at a SaaS company does all day? I have no idea, because I'm that far removed from that side of things. Mm-hmm. My main takeaway is that CFOs go into companies, raise prices and add implementation fees, and that's how companies become profitable. And yeah, they call their customers and destroy legacy pricing. But I don't know, because I'm pretty far removed from that. So I couldn't go start a company and run my own CFO operation out of that company. I would probably outsource it to one of those on-demand CFO firms, because I wouldn't know my head from my butt. I don't know. I have no idea all the things that go into that. And there's just so much more in SaaS than there are in most other owner-operated things, and people just don't understand what they're getting themselves into.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a great point. We have apprenticeship schemes here, and that's kind of very much learning going up the ranks. Okay, I want to switch it up now and talk about how do you know you've got the right people on the team? Because we've talked about all of the different roles and everything like that. So, you know, just looking at it from making sure you've got the right people in the right seat as you scale and grow. How does that happen?
So all these softwares we use to do things have a million dashboards, million reporting tools. You can set your employees up with their own little personal dashboard. Most people don't use them, right? And if people were really interested in refreshing them and constantly looking at their stats and chasing the leaderboard, they'd probably be sitting in your seat if you're a frontline manager. The reality is most people just want to clock in, clock out, and do their job. And so it's kind of like, let's get them putting on their clothes before we ask them to go run around outside. So I typically recommend that everybody actually follows a very manual process to start before they try to implement software, because it does two things. Number one, it gets people interested in the things that they should be following in their inputs. Here's how many calls I made per day. Here's how many emails I sent. Here's how many emails I personalized for my text messages I sent today. Here's how many meetings showed. Here's how many rescheduled. Here's how many I booked. You can get really nitty gritty. Here's how much pipeline I added through discovery calls. And so it gets people focused on what they should be focusing on. And it helps them see like, oh, wow, when I really do this, this is the thing that then affects it. Because they're manually inputting the information. So many times.
Does that mean that you have got the right person in place because they can follow a process?
They can follow a process. And also, when you're doing this, the second part of this is you can see the pushback on the exercise. I don't want the type of person who needs me to show up to a one-on-one, open up their dashboard, show them their performance, and then we discuss it. I want someone who's actively evaluating their own performance and then coming to me in a one-on-one saying, this is where I need help. This is where I'm struggling. I don't want the other person. And there are people that just want to clock in and clock out who are that person. And that's great. That works for me. There's a difference between what someone's motivations for working are and the type of person that they are. They can be different. So I don't mind if someone's a clock puncher, but I want the person who's going to say, all right, Chet, this is where I'm at this week. I really want to focus on this, this, and this. I could use some help here. What do you see in addition to all this stuff? As opposed to me going and looking at the pipeline.
How do you know prior to recruiting that person that it is that's the right characteristics, if that's what you're looking for?
With the rise of TikTok and the spread of information, I will tell you what nobody wants to hear. You never will. You won't know what you have until you're 30 days in. You can scope things as best as you can in the interview process. I have been duped by people myself before. You will never know. People all over the internet are talking about resume hacks, cover letter hacks, interview hacks. There's a guy that his whole TikTok channel, all he did was pull up this like AI chatbot that reads Zoom calls and tells him what to say. And he has no experience in aviation, and he landed an engineering job at Northrop by interviewing with this bot. It told them exactly what to say based on the information they were saying to him and asking him questions. And he was answering with what the bot told him to do. So it goes that deep. And I don't think people understand that. And so for me, there's a laundry list of questions any other expert can tell you when you're interviewing that you can ask. Are they coachable? Do they get feedback? Blah, blah, blah. Some of the most coachable people I thought I was hiring turned out to be the worst bad apples I've ever hired. Some of the people that I was on the fence about, if they were going to be abrasive in feedback and not be cool with flying a plane and building at the same time, ended up becoming frontline managers under me. So for me, when it comes to hiring, I can do the best that I can. And I can ask the questions, and there are tons of LinkedIn gurus that can give you questions probably better than I could even ask. But I firmly believe that you don't know what you have until you get in the weeds with someone.
That is quite a big risk. I mean, I have access to a tool that has been collecting sales-specific, and it's predictive and verified for on-the-job success. So it's got 2.4 million assessments from sales leader down sales manager, A, B, D, all the roles, 200, across 158 countries and 200 industries. So we kind of know sales specific on the job what great looks like. Because I agree with you, it's very much looking into a dark box and not knowing what's in it. And salespeople are the greatest sellers. And also, we often look at past performance. So they did really well. They achieved all of that. Unless you dig deeper into behaviors, you don't know if they're accountable for it or not. But it is so difficult. When I go out speaking and ask a question, there isn't a single sales leader that can't raise their hands and said they've made a bad sales hire. So, you know, CVs is only 18% predictive effectiveness from interviews the same. It's only really poor tools. So there is a way of kind of assessing the people you recruit to match up against or benchmark against what we know great is. And a lot of those softer skills or intrinsic skills that you don't normally come out in interviews will actually tell you, do they have the resilience and the will to sell? You know, do they listen over talking? They may say that, they may even demonstrate it, but this tells you, you know, that they are either recommended to hire against the best or not. So there is, you know, there are kind of new tools that are actually coming out. And this is just, you know, one that's got such a credibility in terms of the number of people that have been through it that we can benchmark across the industries. But it is difficult. It's, you know, it's particularly difficult in this industry. So what I'd like to talk to you about is really how, you know, what one tried and tested strategy you'd offer in order for listeners to scale their sales.
Well, probably back to what I was talking about with like the manual activity thing. I think you have to, you know, Paul Graham, I learned this from Nate Nasrallah, founder of Fluent, fluent.io. And he said this to me once. He said, Chet, sometimes you just got to do things that don't scale. And even share this with like friends of mine, like Leslie Greenwood, you know, and like things she started up. And we talk about this kind of stuff all day long. And it, once you can do the manual thing, then figure out how to build the perfect world of it. But don't wait to do something until you have it completely built out. It's like the fake door test, right? Let's put up a door that doesn't lead to anywhere and see how many people line up in front of it. And if we get a certain number of people, then we'll go build a room with a purpose behind it and see how many people actually walk through the door once they know what it is. Instead, people go and they build an entire house. And then they've spent all this time and resources, and then they put it out and three people line up at the door and they go, oh, well, this must never work. But shut it down. Right. I think this is why you're seeing a lot more startups, especially in the product world, like sustainability products and stuff. A lot of good information, a lot of marketing, or like the Humane AI pin. They put out a great demo, but it's join the wait list. There's a wait list. I firmly believe these companies develop a prototype, great marketing. They spend a lot on digital ad campaigns. They do a lot of PPC. They do a lot of social media marketing. And they see what they get from the wait list, because it's cheaper to do that than to go create a whole company behind something, right? I firmly believe, especially with the stuff that's going on with something like Humane AI's pin, that companies don't perfect it before they release it. It's not this groundbreaking thing. It's the same with Cybertruck. It's a lot cheaper for Elon to build a Cybertruck, show it, and even the one he showed, the glass broke right when the guy hit it with the bat, even though the glass was supposed to be unbreakable. But it was cheaper to do that and then see how many people wanted to go buy $100,000 electric Back to the Future crazy looking truck than it was to go start producing 10,000 Cybertrucks and release a line. And once he said, I got the right amount of people, and then sales at Tesla would call those people and get deposits. Once I started getting enough deposits, I proved the model. Now I'm going to go actually start making this thing. It's the same thing with the new Tesla Roadster and why it hasn't come out yet. And I think people that are attuned to those kinds of founders that are successful are looking at them and going, I should implement something similar. So I'll give you a great example. I tried to do one of my biggest SKOs and like workshops that I do is around sales leadership. And I said, why don't I package that for individuals who might not work at these companies that I'm able to work at and work with? And I put it out online. I put up a wait list. And I said, if I get 30 people to join the wait list, then I could met 10 will sign up. And that's one cohort. I got about 22 people. I decided not to do it because I didn't hit my number. And I thought, based on conversion, what I know from wait list to attendees, based on the price point, I don't want to do a cohort of 5 people. That's just not going to be worth my time from a monetary perspective. It's not going to be worth their time because I won't have the energy or the gusto that I thought I would have if I double that amount. But better to do that than to go build out the whole entire thing and the whole web page and the whole this and the whole that. Absolutely. And then launch it. And then everybody says no. Like, I know people that build these entire founders playbooks. They get 2 people to buy it. And I'm like, that's what you just worked on for half a year. You know what I mean? Like, would have been nice to do some marketing around it and just see how many people signed up. So, You know, yeah. Do V1 of the thing. Don't build the whole thing. Do things that don't scale. Let it be manual. And then figure out how to implement all your automation, your tiny points along the way.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Okay, Chet, how can listeners get hold of you?
Yeah, LinkedIn is probably the best place. You can look me up, Chet Lovgren, L-O-V-E-G-R-E-N. And I'm there. I'm fairly active. Yeah.
Lovely. Well, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for being a guest on Scale Your Sales podcast, Chet.
Thanks for having me, Janice.
Thank you for listening to this week's episode of Scale Your Sales podcast. If you like this discussion, feel free to listen to other episodes or watch the caption show on YouTube and subscribe to future episodes. I would really appreciate it if you would leave a positive review on iTunes. Thank you.